Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Geospatial Analysis for Optimization at Environmental Sites. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to cover some introductory material in the first few slides and then quickly turn the presentation over to our trainers from the ITRC team. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. A few housekeeping items to cover as we get started today. We are scheduled for 2.25 hours. We are recording the session, and we will offer an archive of our training session, assuming the audio quality is good. The trainers are going to control the slides during today's class. If you'd like to control your own slides, you can download the presentation on that CLUIN training page where we started today. Throughout today's training, we are going to have some poll questions, and we do look for your questions and feedback. Anyone is welcome to send in a question anytime in the Q&A box in the lower right. At the question and answer breaks, we're going to ask some of those questions that have come in out loud. If you're on the phone line, you're welcome to unmute your phone and jump in with a question as well. At the end of the class, we do ask that everyone complete the feedback form. We really do use your feedback and appreciate you taking just a few minutes at the end of the training to give us your feedback. The feedback form is also your opportunity to create a certificate for attending today's class. So after you attend the class, be sure to fill out the feedback form, check the box at the bottom to certify you attended. Once you submit, the system's going to generate the certificate for you. If you forget to check the box, just go back, check the box again, because right now the only way to get that certificate is by checking the box at the end of the feedback form. And once you submit, the system generates the certificate. More information about ITRC is available on the ITRC website, which is itrcweb.org. Overall, ITRC is a network that's led by state regulators. It includes our federal partners, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry, academia, and community stakeholders. The full ITRC disclaimer is included in the notes section of the slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. We encourage you to use ITRC's presentations and documents for educational purposes, both in your work and if you need to deliver training to others. We do ask that you please credit ITRC, review the ITRC usage policy, and let us know about your successes. Use of ITRC material for profit is not permitted. More information is available on the ITRC website, and I do encourage you to visit the website. It's a great opportunity to become more involved in ITRC and use some of the many resources that are available. I'll introduce our trainers. For short bios for all of our trainers are available from the CLUIN training page, and we've included a link here on the bottom of the slide. So if you'd like to read more about our trainers, it is available. All of our trainers were members of the ITRC team. Dave Becker is with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Adam Jansen with Barr Engineering Company. Chris Stubbs is with Ramble, and Mike Kuczynski is with the Colorado Division of Oil and Public Safety. I'll now turn today's presentation over to Dave Becker at the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Dave?
Thank you very much. Let's go to the what I call the first milepost slide, and that's kind of a marker that will indicate where we are in the sequence of topics that we'll discuss today. And it's my privilege to cover the first couple of topics here shown on the slide. So do some introductory remarks here and kind of get you in the mindset to hear more. So I would pretty much venture to guess that everybody on the call has at some point or another encountered some type of geospatial analysis, and most commonly that's going to be in either generating or interpreting or otherwise dealing with computer-generated contour maps. And in the environmental field, we often run into these kind of maps where we're contouring groundwater concentrations or groundwater surface elevations or the elevations of different geologic contacts between different strata or whatever. So a lot of these computer-based tools that generate these contour maps are based on the kind of geospatial analysis that you're going to hear more about today. So this is maybe not as unfamiliar as you might think it is. If you're unfamiliar with the concept of geospatial analysis, it's really something we run across quite often. The focus of what we're talking about here, even though we're going to talk a lot about the geospatial analysis methods and tools and things like that, but our real focus with the team was to try and emphasize the application of these methods and tools for the optimization of the work that we do at these environmental sites. And certainly, I would also venture to guess that most people on the call have been asked by their employers or their clients to be more efficient, to try and do more with less. And so there are applications of these tools that we'll talk about today that help us be more efficient. And certainly, as an employee of the Department of Defense and familiar with what other agencies within the government are doing, it's certainly a focus of these agencies to look at optimization. Initially, maybe there was a focus on optimizing projects that have gotten into the construction and operation phases, but now many of the agencies realize that optimization is really something that should be promoted throughout the life cycle of any of our environmental cleanup projects. And ITRC has been in the forefront of providing some guidance on optimization of our environmental cleanup projects in general. There's some documents on the ITRC website that really can help you with other aspects of optimization. And at this point, I should note that any of the bullets that are shown on the slides that have the blue underline, like many of the bullets do here, those are active links. So if you download the presentation, those links will take you to like the ITRC webpage or maybe the EPA CLUIN webpage or the Federal Remediation Technology Roundtable page that have more guidance and tools and case studies about optimization in general. So there are a lot of tools out there, and refer you to those websites. For example, the U.S. Air Force has developed a number of monitoring optimization tools. Three of the logos are shown there, and they're good examples of specific tools for optimization that use geospatial analysis type processes. So this is a much bigger field than what we're talking about here, but we're really encouraging you to use these methods and tools for optimization. Well, let me talk just a little bit about why you really should care about geospatial tools with optimization. Because these tools really do help us do our job better. And I would define, as shown here on this slide, that optimization can be defined as any effort to identify and make happen actions that improve the effectiveness or cost efficiency for that particular phase. So that's kind of a broad definition. As an example here, geospatial analysis can help optimize monitoring programs. And this is the figure on the right there actually illustrates the significant impact that these tools can have on us, on our projects. So we have here on the right, the upper left figure here, an existing contour map color-coded of, say, some type of concentrations or, something like that, based on all the available monitoring points that are available at the site, that are present at the site. To the right here, where my arrow is, the same contaminant concentration or whatever is identified or contoured with a number of wells that have been excluded from the contouring. And you can see by visual comparison that the maps are pretty much the same. In other words, they convey the same information about the site, but without part of the data set. And that implies that these wells shown here in the figure may well be redundant with the other wells that are at the site and could be excluded for the monitoring program, and that could reduce our sampling costs, and we could be more cost efficient about our monitoring program there and yet still make quality decisions. Okay. Now, some of the different ways that geospatial methods can help us optimize our projects. One is through trying to improve the planning that we have in different life cycle phases for the projects. This can help us optimize everything from our characterization in the early phases to the monitoring of ongoing remediation. Can also help us optimize some of our design and construction activities. And it can even at the tail end of our life cycle actually help us demonstrate that we've achieved whatever our cleanup goals were. So it can help us reduce our costs, and it can help us in terms of our evaluation, interpretation of data to make better decisions. And part of that comes from the improved quality of data through the improved planning that I mentioned before. It can also come through using tools to identify trends and patterns in the data that would otherwise be difficult to discern just looking at the tabulated data. As I mentioned, it can help us better estimate the amount of material, say, that we have to excavate or treat, so we can refine our volumes and look at those and interpret those that need treatment a little bit better. So it ultimately helps us make better decisions. And lastly, the geospatial methods help us more effectively share ideas and communicate. A picture really is worth more, than the words. Through the use of some of these geospatial methods to give us visualizations of some of the data, often the three dimensions, we can convey a lot of information both to our colleagues and as well as to the public. So let me kind of give you an example of how geospatial tools can help us actually interpret some of the data. Again, it could really give us some sense of how the contamination at the site may fit in with other site features, in improving our conceptual site model. The figure here on the right is some zinc concentration data from a site near a river. And by plotting the concentrations coded by size of circles there, you can see that a lot of the highest concentrations tend to be focused right along the boundary of the river, whereas lower concentrations are found farther away from the river. And matter of fact, the graph at the bottom of the figure there kind of illustrates how where the distance from the river increases here on the x-axis going to the right, that the concentrations shown on the y-axis tend to diminish. And so that indicates or would suggest that there's some relationship between the river and the soil concentrations of zinc that we're seeing there. And actually, in revising the conceptual site model, a relationship between the periodic floods on this particular river and deposited soil contaminated with zinc became apparent. So this is a good example of how these tools presenting things in a spatial way can help us interpret and understand the site. Certainly, as I mentioned, that the geospatial tools can help us tell stories with the data through visualization. And, we have long had two-dimensional maps and things that present information, but now with the computers available and the tools that we have, very elaborate three-dimensional presentations of data can be made very rapidly. And an example of an image generated with geospatial tools and some of the powerful computer graphics is shown here in almost 3D. So this view could be rotated and tilted to illustrate different points to a room full of stakeholders that would really facilitate their understanding. So let's kind of get back to a poll question here. And just curious, both for me and for the other trainers today, it's good to know what kind of folks we have on the call, what role you might play in the project, so we can maybe anticipate questions, maybe focus on certain things that reflect the composition of our audience today. So if you'd fill out the poll question there about your role, that would be good. If you've got more than one person in the room with you, if you could maybe pick a you know, a discipline or a role that is reflective of most of the people in the room, that would be good. And so watching a little bit here as the results come in that we have, looks like a largest group is, or the technical practitioners applying the methods, that's good. And then another large component are project managers, that's good. And some of the technical folks are involved in review of some of the geospatial analysis. We have some stakeholders too, but looks like we have a fair number of practitioners here, and so hopefully you'll learn some new things and maybe offer some insights or maybe share some experiences during the Q&A activity. So thank you for participating in that poll. Okay. Let's talk now just a little bit about the ITRC geospatial guidance. It's really a cool resource for you that's available on the web. It's very interactive, web-based, has a lot of useful tools in there. So, for example, there are fact sheets that are available, a number of them that will give you easy access, very quick access to common issues that come up with geospatial analysis. There are summaries of different software tools that conduct some of these geospatial methods and kind of gives you at least a qualitative picture of how easy they are to use and how costly they might be or if they're free. So that can be useful. There's kind of a one-stop shop for the project managers. We saw there was a good contingent on the call today. There's a project manager's toolbox that have very quick links to things like the fact sheets and other segments within the guidance so that they can get right to what they need to know. If you're a technical reviewer, and there were a good chunk of folks on the call that are in that role, there's a review checklist that help you ask the right questions to make sure that the methods were applied correctly, and that helps you understand the validity of some of the conclusions that may have been drawn. And then lastly, there are a number of flowcharts that help you kind of through the process of applying geospatial methods. So we'll talk a little bit more about that as we go along here. Okay. So, you know, try to give you a flavor of why this matters, you know, what you've seen before. You know, a little bit about the document. What we're trying to do today with the training is to provide particularly project managers and some of the technical staff some good insights as to how and when geospatial methods would be appropriate to apply, how to use these and ask the right questions about how these could be used in optimizing the actions and decisions at different life cycle phases, help you select the appropriate geospatial method, know a little bit more about them, and by knowing more about them, hopefully being able to explain and apply, defend, or critique the results. You know, in 2 hours, it's pretty much impossible to try and get into a lot of detail. So there's a lot more good information in the guidance document that I mentioned, and I refer you to that for more detail. But hopefully you get a good flavor with what we covered today. So here we are again to another milestone slide here. We finished the introduction, and I just want to say a few things about the application of geospatial analysis and how it kind of fits in with the life cycle of different cleanup projects. So you're going to hear more about geospatial analysis workflow. This is kind of the roadmap, the step-by-step for doing geospatial analysis. It's always good to start with a review of a conceptual site model. It's always good to revisit that periodically. And then for the geospatial analysis, we first would do some what's called exploratory data analysis, just to kind of get a feel for the quantity of data that we have. We then would choose the appropriate geospatial method and then build a geospatial model and then check that model against you know, some criteria for the data. And there are the flowcharts that I mentioned before that would help you go through those three steps. And then the last part, the last step would be to generate the results that would include perhaps predictions or conclusions, as well as the uncertainty surrounding those predictions or conclusions. And again, this is maybe where the review checklist that I mentioned before would come in handy. there's actually a link here at the bottom of the slide that would take you right to the section on workflow. So again, one of the reasons to download the slides there. Here's just an illustration of the completeness of some of the flowcharts here. We have flowcharts actually presented on several pages within the document, but you can follow from one to the other depending on your application. It helps guide you through the step-by-step. Obviously, this is next to impossible to read on the screen, but refer you again to the link at the bottom there to take you to the document to see these on your own, where you can read it more easily and take time to digest the information there. So when it comes to application of these geospatial methods, there's some questions and issues that come up, and including data requirements, regulatory barriers, misapplication, and then again, the focus is how to use these methods to support optimization of our projects. So we're going to talk about each one of these topics now. So regarding the common question about how much data, what kind of data do we need to do these kind of methods, we have flowcharts to help with that, shown here on the left. But the kind of information that you would need, first of all, you need to know what the coordinates are for the data, whether it's water levels, concentrations, geologic contacts, elevations, or points. You need to have the horizontal and vertical coordinates. So that's kind of a key thing for geospatial analysis. Other information about the site is going to be necessary, things like the cleanup goals, other site data like the geology, the groundwater conditions at the site, things like soil moisture content, the organic carbon content of the aquifer. Some of those things may be, appropriate, necessary to have to put things in context. But, most often we're going to need water levels and chemical concentrations. Those are the things that we're really going to be looking at. Now, the amount of data really depends on the kind of geospatial method that you're going to apply, and that's where the flowchart is going to help you better understand the number of data points that you would need in order to do some of the slicing and dicing that these methods entail. A little bit more about some of the regulatory barriers and concerns. It was interesting to see the poll that question that was up at the start. Perhaps we can put that poll back up. Again, just interested to know if people have encountered some barriers, hurdles put before them by various either clients or stakeholders or whoever for the use of geospatial methods. It seems now that many agencies at the state and federal level are very open to optimization and to geospatial analysis. Now, the guidelines, the requirements do vary by agencies, and obviously we should check with them. But, it's really advanced quite a bit, I think, over the last 20 years. In some cases, making changes in light of, what the optimization recommendations might be can be difficult and may require things like an explanation of significant difference or a ROD amendment or other changes to a permit that have their own administrative activities that have to go on that can take time in a schedule. But it still seems to be possible and done quite often. In a lot of cases, there's a hesitancy, perhaps, to use geospatial analysis due to unfamiliarity, and that's something that ITRC was really trying to address with this guidance document. So just looking at the poll results here, that it's about 3-1 people have not really run into significant resistance. But still, hopefully this document and this training will help deal with the other 25% that have encountered some barriers to using these techniques. So we're working on it. Okay. go on now. Just a few things about common misapplications, and you'll hear more from my fellow trainers. Some of the typical misapplications, again, there's a fact sheet on this, either applying some of the methods without having the appropriate amount of data, extrapolating the data outside the boundaries of where we actually have the observed data points. It becomes very tricky and subject to a lot of uncertainty if we extrapolate very far from where we have data. It's more, a lot of these methods are more interpolation as opposed to extrapolation. So that can be a significant misapplication to extrapolate the data. In a lot of cases, the subsurface heterogeneity, things like pinch-out contacts or faults or those kind of things, are not well dealt with by some of the methods, and that can be a problem. Matter of fact, the example here, the figure on the right, shows water levels measured on either side of a fault, and a contouring routine has contoured the data without consideration for the fault, whereas a human or maybe a more sophisticated method would take into account the potential for this fault to be a barrier. So that's an example of how there may be some misapplication or limitations there. Other considerations might be the impact of having non-detects or other censored data in your data set, how to deal with that, or not dealing with them appropriately. And in pretty much most cases, you really need to keep in mind that your data are not necessarily certain. There's maybe some uncertainties associated with them. You're going to hear more from Adam here in just a bit about some of that. anyway, so there is a fact sheet on these things to hear more about misapplications. Lastly, as I mentioned, the real goal is to try and optimize our projects using these geospatial methods. And the way that the document has approached this is that for different phases in the life cycle, everything from release detection through characterization, remediation, on to closure, we've identified some common optimization questions and just some examples, representative examples of these questions for the different phases are shown here. There's a lot more in the document. These questions then are shown, and then the guidance document offers some of the geospatial tools that or methods that can be applied to answer these questions, identify some of the tools or link you to some of the tools that can conduct the analysis for you to help you answer these questions. So that is a very helpful thing. You can go right to the questions for the phase that you've got for the project in question. So let me just kind of go through an example, in this case, for the site characterization phase. Maybe the question is, what is the appropriate sample spacing for soil or groundwater at the site, particularly considering how samples taken closely spaced may be more correlated than samples spaced farther apart. So you can, really consider this where you're trying to be more cost-effective in your sampling approach, and geospatial analysis can help you estimate the appropriate sample spacing that minimizes the amount of correlation, in other words, a duplication of information by having your sample spaced too closely together, or to miss information by having them spaced too far apart. So, the method that you might apply would be geostatistical and would involve constructing a variogram, and you're going to hear more about that here in just a bit. And you would look at the variogram, use what's called the geostatistical range as a basis for the sample spacing, so that you're minimizing the amount of duplicative information that you get by having the sample spaced too close together. And the document would identify the software that would be available to do this kind of variogram construction. So you're going to hear more about that here in just a bit. So where do we go from here? Well, you're going to hear more about methods. And the document and this training really categorize some of the geospatial methods into three categories: a simple, more complex, and advanced. And then software tools are identified in the document and here to some extent to help you implement those simple, more complex, or advanced methods. So that pretty much gets us to the end of my material. We thought we'd throw in another poll question here. Just based on what you've heard from me, do you think that you have some applications that could benefit from geospatial analysis? So, wow, as we get the answers in here, just watching the numbers come in, over 90% say yes. Well, that's good. And for those, 7% or so that aren't sure yet, hang with us, and you're going to hear more as we go forward here. So let me advance to our next milepost slide. I'm going to turn it over now to Adam Jansen with Barr Engineering in Minneapolis to talk about the fundamentals of geospatial methods.
Okay, thanks, Dave. So our goal for this next fundamental section is to give you kind of a high-level understanding of how geospatial methods work. So whether you're a practitioner or a reviewer, just to have some idea of what's going on kind of under the hood in the software so that you can be sure the methods are being applied correctly. Now, I mean, in the next 20 minutes, we can't get into a ton of detail on this stuff, and it gets very technical very fast, but I'll remind you that there's a lot more information available in the guidance document. So Tobler's first law of geography here on this slide sums up the basic premise of geospatial methods pretty well, which is, I mean, if we go out and collect samples at a couple of locations that are really close together, we'd expect the sample results to be pretty similar. But if we went out and collected two samples at locations far away, you know, we wouldn't expect them to be so similar. So this relationship between similarity and proximity is called spatial correlation. And if we have a spatial correlation in our data set, we can quantify it using geospatial methods. And so the whole idea is to try to be able to quantify that relationship to help us understand what's going on in between our data points and be able to say with some certainty what the values might be at places where we don't actually have data. And we can also use that relationship then to help us identify areas where maybe we need more data points, we don't understand that area well enough, or conversely, help us identify where we may have redundant data points that we could quit sampling in the future and maybe try to save a little money. So this slide is meant to illustrate what spatial correlation looks like. So we have some hypothetical data sets here plotted. On the left, we have one where there is no spatial correlation. So the different colors and symbol sizes appear to be randomly distributed in space. So there's no correlation here. We can't use geospatial methods on this data set. But contrast what this looks like with the other two cases, where clearly there is some pattern. In the middle, we have what's known as a trend. It's a large-scale systematic variation in the data. So you see these colors kind of smoothly vary from the upper left to lower right corner of the figure. Now, as an example of what this could be showing us, these could be water levels measured at wells. And so this is showing us we kind of have a one-dimensional groundwater flow field towards the lower left corner of the figure. On the far right here, we have what's called an autocorrelation, or a bounded spatially correlated variation, where essentially we have clumps of similar values. You know, for example, these could be concentrations of some chemical in the subsurface at a former industrial site. So what this is trying to show us is that the bars here are there to indicate the apparent scale of the spatial correlation. So at distances greater than that, points tend not to be very similar. They tend to be very similar when they're spaced closer together in that. That's a very important concept we'll talk a little bit more about in a few slides. We should note that the trend and the autocorrelation components are not mutually exclusive, that sometimes our data sets are going to have some combination of both. And so to further illustrate that on this next slide, imagine we took a cross-section here, a slice through a very high-resolution data set. So that's the black line. We can see there's a lot of variability in this, but there tends to be this more general overarching pattern that we've traced with the blue line. So the blue line here would be the trend, and then the autocorrelation component then is the deviation from the trend. A geospatial model can include up to three components here, the trend, error, and the autocorrelation. So we've already talked about what the trend and the autocorrelation mean. The error model is there if we want to include error to account for measurement error. And so As Dave alluded to in the previous section, the guidance document groups geospatial methods into three categories: simple, more complex, and advanced. And then those categories are based on which components of a geospatial model you could simulate using those that particular method. So any of the methods could be used to simulate or model a trend. As soon as we want to include an error model into the analysis, we have restricted to using the more complex or advanced methods. And then the differentiating factor for the advanced methods is being able to explicitly model the autocorrelation component. On this slide here, we'll show you some of like the typical names of the methods that fall under the different categories. So the simple methods, you may have heard of some of these, like natural neighbor, inverse distance weighting. These are all basic interpolation methods that more or less are just different ways of connecting the dots between your points in space. The more complex methods are various types of regressions that are basically forming kind of a best fit surface to your data. The advanced methods are based on that. They're similar to regressions, but then they include this explicit autocorrelation model. The advanced methods are what you may have heard called the geostatistical methods. So the basic geostatistical method is kriging, and then there are many different types of kriging that have been developed for specific applications. Because we've classified geospatial methods kind of based on their capabilities, you know, it follows that some of them might be better for certain applications than others. So the simple methods work very well for just helping you generate a continuous surface from input point data. So if you're just trying to make a map that kind of shows contours or like color flood, you know, generated from points, simple methods can work pretty well for that. So you'd evaluate the results of the method, making sure it's consistent with your conceptual site model, you know, before you present it. But if we're looking at the optimization tasks, and like that's a big, you know, component of this presentation, how do you use these methods to optimize your sampling approach? In order to be able to optimize, we need to be able to understand measures of uncertainty. So like we're estimating points in between our data, but we need to be able to put some bounds of uncertainty on those estimates. And so to do that, we can't use the simple methods. We have to use either the more complex or advanced methods, because those are based on statistical modeling that will give us those uncertainty numbers. That's not to say, though, you can't use those methods for like simple tasks like making maps, but one example I want to caution you about, so I'm sure many of us have used Surfer. It's a very user-friendly software. It's very easy to load a point data set, generate a contour map using kriging, which is an advanced method, and not have to do any of this statistical modeling. And that's because there are some default settings in Surfer that allow you to do that. So I want to caution you in that case, you know, the contour map you generate is just fine, but don't trust any of the uncertainty estimates that the kriging method generates, because you haven't done the modeling that those are based on. So in a case where you're using any default parameters in the software with a more complex or advanced method, you're effectively converting it to a simple method. So to kind of sum up where we are at this point, if we have spatial correlation in our data set, that allows us to use geospatial methods in the first place. But we need to be careful, because if we have spatial correlation, simply adding more data points to our data set doesn't necessarily give us more information. And that's because it also matters how the points are located relative to one another. You know, the big danger here is that we're spacing points too close together, so that we're collecting information that we already had. And to try to avoid doing that, we need to understand what the scale of the spatial correlation is, to be sure we don't space points too close together. So we get that scale using something called the variogram. The variogram basically is a plot of variability on the y-axis versus spacing between pairs of points on the x-axis. The advanced methods need an autocorrelation model. So kriging is an example of an advanced method. The variogram is the autocorrelation model. But even if you're using simpler or more complex methods, you're not even going to generate an interpolation at all, it's still useful to make a variogram to help us quantify what that scale of spatial correlation is. So this is kind of what a classic variogram looks like. And so the individual points on this figure are what are known as the experimental or empirical variogram. Now, these are not actually your data points. Like the points that are shown on here are derived from a lot of number crunching of the raw data set. And like the details of that sausage making exercise are described in a lot more detail in the guidance document. But once you get that, then you fit a theoretical variogram model to it. That's the solid red line. And you see this illustrates that basic premise of geospatial methods, and that variability here is small when points are close together. As the points get farther apart, the variability also increases, but only up to a point. Once you get past a certain distance here, then the variability tends to level off. And so that distance is that scale of spatial correlation. It's also known as the range of the variogram. This value here of variability that the variogram levels off to is called the SIL of the variogram, which is theoretically the variance of your data set. And there's one more feature of the variogram, which is the y-intercept of the variogram model, which is called the nugget. And I'll talk more about that in a few slides, but that's where you would incorporate an error model into this analysis. Now, because we are generating this variogram looking at variability compared to distances between points, it also matters like what direction we're looking between points. You know, and a good example of that would be two-dimensional versus 3D problems. And so like a place where we've collected samples at different depths, you know, we have variability in the data set that's related to points being at different XY locations, but also samples collected from different depths. And so the guidance document talks about how to separate out those two sources of variability when you're making the variogram. So let's go back to that illustration that we showed earlier of the different what spatial correlation looks like and show you what a variogram would look like for each of these three cases. So where we have no spatial correlation, we just get a horizontal line for the variogram. The case of the trend, we get an unbounded variogram, because that's when we're doing the variogram construction, we're comparing distances between points to the differences in the values. And as especially along this axis of the trend, the farther apart we go, the more different the values keep getting. And so that's why this variogram just goes on to infinity, and it never reaches a SIL. And then finally, the autocorrelation case gives us the shape of the variogram that we saw on the previous slide, where, you know, at small distances less than the length of these black bars, which is equivalent to the range of the variogram, you have points that are pretty similar, but then once you start getting outside of that, it starts to look a lot more like the figure on the far left, and you get the horizontal line. And we think this is a great time to bring in a pop quiz. And so this is the same variogram that we showed on the previous slide, just this time there are numbers on the axes, and so we're going to ask you what are the range and the SIL of this variogram. And so while people are having a chance to answer this, I'm going to talk a little bit more about the nugget on the variogram. And so as I said before, the nugget's the y-intercept here of the variogram model, and this is where you would incorporate an error model into the analysis. With a nugget of zero, like what we have on this figure, that's saying that if we went out and we collected two samples at exactly the same location, we should get exactly the same result. And while it may sound like, you know, in a perfect world, that would be true. Like, we know that there's error in our measurements. You know, we can, you know, collect duplicate samples from the same monitoring well at the same time and still get different results. And so that tells us there's obviously error in the lab methods. And so it's, if we have an understanding of what that error is, like based on analysis of duplicate samples or just knowing what the precision of our measurement instruments are, those numbers will help guide us as to what would be an appropriate value to use for the nugget. So it looks like here most people have had a chance to answer this. So I'm going to go ahead and close the poll here and show you the results. And then we're going to reveal the answer, which is C, which most people got. The range is 24 on this variogram, and the SIL is 9. And so just to recap, the SIL was theoretically the variance of our data set, and that's where the variogram wants to level off to. And then the range of the variogram is this scale of spatial correlation. That's the distance at which it reaches the SIL, and then this has important implications for sample spacing. And as an example of that, I'm going to talk about one of the case studies that's in the guidance document. So this is a sediment contamination site in New Jersey where there were sediment contaminated with PCBs. The authors of this study went out over a 7-year period and collected 749 samples of this sediment and then to use to help them delineate the area that they would have to remediate that had concentrations above the standard. After they did that, though, they're like, wow, 749 was a lot of data points. Did we really need this many? So they went back and did a retrospective geospatial analysis to see if maybe they could have been a little smarter with their sampling approach. So what they found after the first 2 years of sampling, they had collected 240 data points. They generated a variogram from those data and found out that it had a range of 400 feet. If they had taken that range of 400 feet into account when deciding where to put additional samples, so trying not to put any new points within 400 feet of a point they'd already collected, they found that they really only needed 24 more points on top of what they already had. Of course, in real life, they went out over the next 5 years and collected another 509 samples. So this is a pretty dramatic example, but you know, you can infer that the savings in both time and money would have been pretty tremendous, you know, had they started using geospatial methods once they had kind of an understanding of the site just to make sure that they weren't collecting a lot more data than they really needed. On this slide, we're going to show six different contour maps that were all generated from the same data set, but using different geospatial methods. So the goal here is just to highlight some of the similarities and differences between the methods, because they all work differently. Start out with a couple of very simple methods here, so triangulation and natural neighbor. So I said just basically ways of kind of connecting the dots in two dimensions here. One thing you'll notice right away about these is that by definition, these two methods can only interpolate. So you see that there's a very sharp edge here, like the limits of the data are the limits of the interpolation. Also a simple method, but you know, it works very differently, gives us a very different result, is inverse distance to a power, also known as inverse distance weighting. So the way this works is it takes a weighted sum of nearby data points to estimate a value at an unsampled location. Those weights are based on an inverse power function of the distance between points. So because of the way that this works, you can see that it tends to give you bullseyes around your data points. And depending on what you're trying to do, that could be okay. But I'll caution you to be very careful when using inverse distance weighting. Be very careful to look at the results and compare them against your conceptual site model and make sure the results make sense. You know, in particular, if you're going to be generating contours of groundwater elevations, be very careful using inverse distance weighting, because if it introduces a lot of closed contours in here that don't really have any physical meaning in the groundwater sense, they're just coming as an artifact of the method you use. I mean, that could lead you to develop some conclusions from the results that aren't exactly appropriate. Moving on to a more complex method, the local polynomial regression here gives us a much smoother surface than we've seen from any of the simple methods. And that's because, you know, unlike the simple methods, which have to exactly match all of the data points, this regression doesn't. And so it produces more kind of a best fit surface that can be much smoother, which could also be an issue, and we'll talk about implications of that in a few slides here. The radial basis functions, also a more complex method, do a better job of locally matching data and give you a very similar map to what you get from kriging. Kriging also works like inverse distance weighting, and then it uses a sum of nearby data points, but it generates the weights using the variogram. And so as you can see, it doesn't really give you all of the closed contours or bullseyes that you would see from inverse distance weighting. Now that we have all six of them up here on the screen, I mean, don't be alarmed that we got, in some cases, radically different results from the same data set. Because, you know, as I tried to illustrate, these methods all have different assumptions and work differently. You know, the obvious question, though, is which one's the most appropriate to use? And that'll depend on questions like, you know, what are you actually trying to do with the analysis? What's the question you're trying to answer? And also how much data you have. And so there are some very comprehensive flowcharts in the guidance document that will help guide you toward the choice of what the most appropriate method is for your particular situation. So methods like kriging and inverse distance weighting that work as a weighted sum of nearby data points, you have to define what counts as a nearby data point. And so the software does that using a parameter called the search neighborhood. So we've illustrated that here in this figure. The search neighborhood is the circle. And then we're going to estimate a value at the center of the circle using all the data points that fall within it. If you ever generate a map that looks like the one on the lower left here, where like on this color flood, we have really sharp separations between colors, or if we drawn contours, we would have had really jagged looking contours. This is almost always caused by the search radius being too small. So we can smooth out this map considerably, get rid of all those really sharp transitions just by increasing the value of the search neighborhood radius. Exact interpolation is another way of saying that the interpolation method honors your data. So everywhere that you actually have a data point, the method should return that exact value. By definition, most of the simple methods have to be exact interpolators. More complex methods don't necessarily need to be, and kriging can go either way. And that depends on what value you use for the nugget in the variogram. So the nugget, remember, is the y-intercept. That's where you would incorporate the error model. If you use zero nugget in the variogram, kriging is an exact interpolator. So that's what was done here for this upper figure here on the right. So we exactly matched all of these data points, and that gives us kind of a strange-looking map in some places. You know, some of these contours take some really abrupt, sudden turns just because we forced it to match all the data points. If we were to use a non-zero nugget in the variogram, that would be incorporating some error in the measurements. Like we know that, you know, they're not all exactly right, and so then that removes the constraint in kriging that it has to match all the points. So then this lower map was generated using the non-zero nugget with kriging in the same data set. You can see we get a much smoother figure. But it can be very difficult to justify this lower map to a client or to a regulator when you can look very closely at it, like we're going to do here, and see that uh-oh, you have a 170 point between your 165 and 170 contours. You have a 149 here, where it looks like it should be about 152. I'm going to conclude this map is wrong. And so for that reason, we're often forced to use exact interpolation just because of the, you know, it's perceived to be accurate, whereas the inexact map might not be. But there are definitely cases where if you feel like you have, there's a lot of error in your data and you know that, you can make a pretty strong case that the inexact map may actually be more appropriate. So I work mostly with groundwater in various ways, and various state well databases often give very inexact locations for wells. So in some cases, the best you might do is getting the nearest quarter-quarter section in the public land survey. And so if I'm drawing a contour map with water levels from that database, should I really be trying to make the contours take all kinds of crazy bends and turns to exactly match all the points when I know going into this the locations could be off by hundreds of feet? So that's just an example of, you know, a case of when, like, you may be able to make a strong justification that the inexact interpolation is actually more appropriate because there's a lot of error in the data. So the geospatial methods, like anything, they're only as good as the data that you give them. And so we need to be very careful to include all necessary features, like any boundary conditions or any important features in the conceptual site model that would inform the interpolation. So this example we're going to show, our conceptual model here is that we have a shallow alluvial aquifer adjacent to the Big River, which is known to be a gaining stream in this area. Some contamination was discovered here at MW1, and so a pump-out well, PW1, was installed to capture it. Once the well was operational, they went out and took a number of water levels, all these black dots, drew a contour map, and then inferred a downgradient flow direction from MW1. And sure enough, it goes straight to the pumping well. So, hey, it looks like everything's good, right? If we take a closer look at this map, though, there are some issues with it. So first and foremost, we have contours here that are perpendicular to the river. That would indicate that there's no flow between the aquifer and the river, which violates our conceptual site model. So clearly the interpolation didn't know that the river was there. The other issue with this is a little more subtle, but there are an awful lot of closed contours on this contour map, even though only one of these wells is actually pumping. And that's because inverse distance weighting was used to generate the contours. And so it generated some bullseyes around a few of these data points that don't have any physical meaning. You know, if we go and do a kind of second chance on this and try again using kriging instead of inverse distance weighting and then including the elevation of the river in the elevation data set, now we get a contour map that's much more consistent with our conceptual site model, but it gives us an exactly opposite conclusion that, you know, the well is not capturing the contamination at MW1. So just a reminder here to be sure that you include all necessary data in the analysis to be sure that you can draw the conclusions from it that you're looking for. So that wraps up the fundamental section. I know this went pretty quickly, but, you know, these are kind of the basics that we need to know before we start getting into some examples for how to apply the methods, which Chris is going to do here in the next section. So a couple of the key points that we want to summarize. You must have spatial correlation in the data set in order to be able to use geospatial methods in the first place. Our geospatial model is made up of trend, error, and our autocorrelation components. We need to identify that scale of spatial correlation to know, you know, like what is an optimal sample spacing. We do that using a concept known as the variogram. And be very careful that your conceptual site model is consistent with whatever geospatial method you decide to use. So at this point, we're going to take a question and answer break, and then after that, Chris Stubbs from Ramble is going to go through some step-by-step examples.
Thanks, Adam. Anyone is welcome to send in a question using the Q&A pod in the lower right. And as we're going through this question and answer break, we do have another poll question for people to answer as we're answering other questions. Have you used, are you considering geospatial methods in performing optimization of your projects? For our phone line audience, you're welcome to unmute. It's #6 to unmute. And at this point, Mike Kwiecinski, are you able to unmute the line?
I am here.
We hear you now. Thank you so much, Mike.
Great. Thanks.
As we're waiting for some questions to come in, I do want to remind you, at the end of the class, we do ask that everyone complete the feedback form. We really do use the information that you provide. The feedback is also your opportunity to create a certificate of participation for today's training class. So if you are interested in a certificate, be sure to complete the feedback form. Check the box at the bottom to certify you attended. Once you submit, the system's going to generate that certificate for you. So if you forget to check the box, just go back, check the box, submit again, because right now it's only the feedback form that allows you to generate that certificate. We have a question that's come in. In the example on slide 45, how is the river data, the linear feature, incorporated into the interpolation?
Right, so the input data are points, but then, of course, the river is a line, and so we just have to convert the line into points. So it's just taking a representing the river as kind of a dense line of points, you know, all at, you know, the river elevations, and then including those points, you know, in with the groundwater elevations.
Thank you. Again, for phone line participants, if you'd like to, it's #6 to unmute. You can jump in with a question. Also, everyone's welcome to use that Q&A pod to send in questions. We'll give it just a little bit more time to see if we have a few more questions that come in. We do have to hope to have more time at the end of today's training for questions as well. Is it possible to weigh different data based on the perceived reliability of the data? For example, in creating grantor contour maps with mixed water level data, some data collected as part of the, and other data is either at a, other dates or historic dates. So some data is current and others at historic dates. So can you weigh the data differently?
Yeah, I mean, most of the methods are going to weight all the data kind of the same. There is a particular method of kreeging called co-kreeging, where you have what kind of goes like primary and secondary data. And Chris will talk more about co-kreeging in the next section. But it's where you have some data that, like, you think are very reliable, and then, you know, if you have a way to relate them to, like, the less reliable data, you can incorporate all of them in the analysis. But for most of the methods, you know, I don't think there's a great way of being able to weight them differently based on if you think some are more reliable than others. It kind of just weights everything the same.
Adam, this is Dave Ecker. Do you think it would be possible to possibly just try to generate contours, and see how they change by adjusting the value of the more uncertain data, maybe varying them within a range just to see what the impact might be on the output from the methods that you might use?
Yeah, that's a good idea, Dave. You could try to do something like that. I mean, you could generate contours, like, leaving out what you think are the less accurate data, you know, and then just kind of compare some of the results at those points, you know, just to see, like, you know, does it still seem consistent, like, with what I got, and assuming that it's not there, or, like, do I really need that data point, you know, in that location to try to inform the contours there? You know, normally when we try to do these things, it's kind of a stationary picture that you're trying to paint. So, like, it's best to use a synoptic round because everything's from the same time, you know, and, like, mixing data sets from different times, you know, can be appropriate if the system's not changing much, you know, but if there's a lot of variability from event to event, you're probably going to introduce some artifacts in the interpolation by mixing those different times.
Does the guidance document go over boundary conditions or more on how to manage shorelines?
I don't know if we discuss shorelines in there specifically, but there's definitely more information in there about, you know, how to include different types of boundary conditions. I mean, the one that we focused on here in the presentation was, like, I would say, like, a constant head boundary in groundwater, but, you know, the fault, like that Dave showed in the first part of the section, would be a no-flow boundary. And we do talk about how to incorporate features like that, you know, where there shouldn't be any flow across it.
Can standard deviation be related to the variance in the graphic presented by Adam?
Yes, yeah. I mean, like, sometimes we'll show a map, and Chris will do this in the next section, like being able to show an error map, you know, spatially of your data set. Like, after you do the interpolation, you can, you know, you'll get a value called the Kriging variance. So, like, it's the error of estimation that's associated with each of the values that it estimates, and then you can take the square root of that, you know, and show that as kind of a standard deviation of the interpolation at that location.
Is it possible to include site lithology, the different geologic layers, in a vertical cross-section interpolation of contaminated concentrations, for example?
Yes. I mean, you could do a two-dimensional interpolation, you know, along a cross-section, you know, and then try to include the different layering as an anisotropy in the variogram, or try to do a three-dimensional interpolation, you know, also where you may need to include some anisotropy to account for the different layering. You know, the anisotropy, the directional dependence can get pretty complicated, so it's not something that we touched on in this presentation, but I know there's a lot more discussion of that in the guidance document.
Has anyone used these methods for analyzing subsurface landfill fires?
Yeah, personally, I'm not aware of that, but
yeah, me neither. I'm trying to think of how you might do that. You know, these methods could, you know, be applied to contour, maybe measure temperatures and landfill vents or something like that, that would help you kind of highlight more systematically hot spots, you know, or you know, looking at even carbon monoxide data from, you know, again, monitoring landfill vents or something like that, that would also give you some sense for, you know, where the hot spots literally are. At least that's the way I would kind of look at it.
Thank you. We'll go ahead and wrap up this question and answer break. So do you have a few more questions? And hopefully we'll have time to address those at the end of today's presentation. For now, we'll continue on with the second half of today's training class. And I'm going to turn the presentation over to Chris Stubbs at Ramble.
Okay, great. Thanks very much. Okay, so in this next section, we'll talk about some application of these methods to some example problems. Basically, there's three parts to this next section. We'll talk first in a little more in general about modeling the data and using it for optimization, go into a bit more detail about the geospatial analysis workflow and how to quantify uncertainty. And then we'll look at an example using a more complex method. And as part of that discussion, we'll review what an exploratory data analysis might look like, and then show an example of using nonparametric regression. And then the third part, we'll look at that same example, but we'll apply an advanced method, kreeking in this case, and talk about a few other concepts such as model evaluation and some variations on kreeging or some other advanced methods, conditional simulation and co-kreeging. So just to get started here, we'll be focusing on modeling the data and using it for optimization purposes. So that means we'll be thinking about the more complex and advanced methods. Generally, these work better for optimization because the predictions are more accurate, and we can quantify the uncertainty in our predictions, and that can help us optimize our sampling. Either include more samples if they're needed or reduce our sampling if it's too much. So, and I think as Adam mentioned, this modeling of the data kind of goes beyond just mapping the data because we're actually going to fit a statistical model to the data. Now, the simple methods generally you don't fit a model to the data. You just apply the algorithm to the data and you sort of don't really pay any attention to any details of the data. And that's fine for making good maps, and in some cases, if you have just tons and tons of data, a simple method will be the best approach for creating a map. But if like I said, you want to kind of go beyond that and assess the accuracy of the predictions, then you need to take this more rigorous approach of actually modeling the data. Okay, so we are going to present a geospatial workflow, which is useful for both practitioners and reviewers. So the practitioners, people who are conducting the geospatial analysis. And they can then follow this workflow to learn how to model the data and remind them to document each step along the way. And the reviewers can refer to the workflow because it can remind them of what should be done in order to document each step of the way and verify that the model that was selected or the approach that was selected is appropriate and is going to give good results. So here's the workflow again. It's got these five steps to it, starting with reviewing the conceptual site model and the project goals. Think about the key site features that need to be represented with the method and the questions that we need to answer. Well, I suggest we always start with some exploratory data analysis to look at the distribution of the data, look for outliers, trends, and spatial correlation, and also think about any auxiliary or secondary data that would be useful for including. Then we'll choose a method. And as we said, we've categorized the methods into these three buckets: simple, more complex, and advanced. And if you look in the guidance, you'll find some good information about how to select a method and some flowcharts and so forth that can help you with that. After we select the method, we're going to build a model, fit our model to our data, check the model's working, do some additional checks to make sure the predictions are accurate using cross-validation, and then always we want to think about whether the results are consistent with our conceptual site model. And then finally, we'll generate the results, take a look at those predictions, and look at the uncertainty in them. Just a reminder here of how we measure uncertainty with these geospatial methods. And these are kind of the statistical way of measuring uncertainty. And probably everyone's heard of these terms, but I just thought I'd review them briefly. Out of the models, we tend to get a standard error or a variance, and that's the measure of uncertainty. So if the standard error variance is high, then we have less confidence in those predictions. And we get these standard error variance out of pretty much all of the more complex and advanced methods, and we don't get them out of the simple methods. And using the standard error variance, we can generate confidence or prediction intervals, which can be a little easier for most people to interpret, which kind of show the, like, for example, the 95% confidence interval around a prediction. So we get a sense of how far off we could be. Another way of presenting uncertainty is with exceedance probabilities. If we have a map, we can sort of map out the probability of at a particular spot that our prediction is going to exceed the threshold that's of interest, such as a risk-based concentration, something of that nature. So here's just a quick illustration of what this might look like. And we have our data here. We're just looking at a kind of a 1D transect of say, concentration as a function of distance along a transect. So here's our data, and we kind of fit a model to it. And here, of course, we're not fitting the model exactly to the data. We're just taking it through a nice kind of best fit line through the data. And if we add the standard error, we kind of get these little error bars along the whole model. You see it might be a little wider in some areas near the ends or when there's a bit less data. And then we can convert that standard error into a confidence interval. So here's our confidence interval. So we kind of expect that this trend through the data is always going to be within that confidence limit. All right, let's get to our example. So we're going to start off with this looking at a more complex method, and we've seen this this figure before. This was representing soil samples that were collected near a river, and we've measured a bunch of metals, but here we're just showing the zinc concentration. So the concentrations are bigger where we have the larger circles. So you kind of see, just looking at this, suggests perhaps a conceptual site model feature, which would be that since the concentrations seem to be a bit larger near the river, that it's probably associated with flooding from the river. It's just causing these elevated concentrations in the floodplain nearest the river. All right, so let's think about what our questions are that we're going to look at in this example. So we might be interested in the mean or average zinc concentration, and we might want to compare it to a risk-based level. So we'll look at the 95% upper confidence limit of the mean zinc concentration. And then for this example, we're going to also look at what kind of a secondary or proxy data that might be available to us that we can use to help us improve our predictions of the zinc. So starting off with the exploratory data analysis, we can do some histograms of the distribution of zinc. So first, we've got a histogram where we're just looking at the raw zinc concentrations, and we see it's skewed. In other words, there's many more concentrations that are smaller than there are larger. Generally, when we're doing this kind of a statistical approach, we don't want such skewed data. We'd prefer to have something that's more normal or bell-shaped. So one thing we can do, particularly if it's a concentration, is take the logs of those concentrations. So here, if we take the logs and redo the histogram, we see less of a skewed and it's kind of a little more normally distributed. So we'll continue with this log concentrations when we go forward with our modeling. Of course, we want to look at the autocorrelation, and to do that, we use a varigram. So if we put the log zinc into a varigram, we get a very nice classical-looking varigram that shows us that, yes, there is spatial correlation in this data, in the sense that samples that are closer together are less are more alike than samples that are farther apart. And we sort of see we do reach a sill over here, maybe around 800 meters. It's sort of flattening out, so there's not any additional correlation, autocorrelation past 800 meters or so. All right, looking a little bit more at some secondary data that might be useful. Just thinking back to our conceptual site model, it's the flooding from the river causing the deposition of the zinc impacted sediments. So if we kind of just calculate using our GIS software the distance of each sample from the river, then we can construct this scattergram of the concentration as a function of the distance from the river. And I've kind of put a little trend line through there so you can see the pattern. And clearly, there is a very clear pattern that the concentrations are higher closer to the river. So that's something that we can take advantage of and use this as an additional piece of information in our model. And we'll look at some other things that might be useful. We've recorded, or we have a map of soil types here. I've just called them, types 1, 2, and 3. But if we look at the sample results within each of the soil types and summarize them using a box plot, we see that, in general, the samples from soil type 1 tend to be higher. So these lines here in the box plots are the medians, in the middle of the box here. So the median is definitely higher for type 1, and then type 2 is a bit higher than type 3. So, that's an example of a categorical variable where we just have a fixed number of values it can take. And we can with these more complex methods, we can often incorporate in these categorical variables into our model and take advantage of the information that they have. So, this is a copy of a page from the guidance document, and you can see, down here, there's the link to where you would find it. But it's just a summary of when you want to consider using these more complex methods. And as has been described previously, these more complex methods are regression-type methods. They don't have a spatial correlation model. We're just relying on the actual, secondary data sources to describe what's going on. The nice thing about them is they're very flexible. We can incorporate all kinds of different types of data, and it's a little easier to incorporate key features such as faults and rivers And, you know, it works well when we have a lot of extra predictor variables or extra, you know, data from of other types that we can use. There's some assumptions that we need to be mindful of, that the residuals from the regression, so after we do the regression and just look at the difference between the predicted values and the actual data values, those need to be, you know, spatially uncorrelated and normally distributed. So we need to check on that, and the nice thing is that we do get prediction standard errors and variances out of these methods. And here's just a list of the typical choices of more complex methods that we can use. Parametric regression is kind of the one that we're all probably most familiar with. You know, linear regression, things like that that you learn in your basic statistics courses. But we can do a little more flexible things by using splines or kernel smoothing, which are basically just methods that can be used in a non-parametric regression approach, which gives us more flexibility and kind of smoother surfaces. Let's take a look at that. So here we've got the example of, you know, what a surface created using parametric regression. So here's a quadratic surface where we're looking at the, you know, predicting the a value of interest just based on a, you know, quadratic model of the coordinates. And you can kind of see, you know, it's very, you know, smooth and uniform. But if we use a non-parametric approach, we can kind of come up with, you know, using the same inputs, much more flexible surfaces, which tend to be more realistic than is what we see in the field. So these non-parametric approaches can be quite useful. Okay, so we've, in our workflow, we're selecting our method. We're going to look at these more complex types of approaches because we do have this secondary data that we've identified as part of our exploratory data analysis. And we'll use a non-parametric regression, and we're going to feed into it all these different types of data, the distance to the river, the soil type, and in the example, this example is from the guidance. In the guidance, we also include the flood frequency, which is also also correlated with the concentration. And we're going to fit this thin plate spline, which is kind of a flexible type of mathematical surface, to the trend in the data, in taking into account all these other input variables. Anyway, after we do that, we can use these techniques of cross-validation to sort of see which of the variables we should include and which we don't need, and that's gone into a little more detail in the online guidance. All right, so we put it in the non-parametric regression, and this is what we get. So here we've got the predictions. So these are the predicted log sync. Nice to see that the concentrations are, you know, definitely higher along the river, sort of, you know, quite consistent with our conceptual site model. And then here's the standard errors in the next figure here. You know, basically we get some higher errors where the concentrations are higher. So that's sort of makes some sense. And, you know, as I mentioned, the regression type approaches have this assumption that the residuals don't have any autocorrelation or spatial correlation. So if we take the residuals after we've, you know, kind of subtract off that regression from the data, here we see a varigram that's totally flat across there. And when you see a varigram like that, that means there's no autocorrelation in the data. So we've met that assumption. So we're fine to continue with this method. And then this is the time when we'd actually use the model for optimization. So as I said, we can calculate the average concentrations with confidence limits, you know, the upper confidence limit, compare it to a remediation target. And then we might take a look at the maps of uncertainty to figure out where some additional samples might be located. And then we might find some of the areas that need to be targeted for remediation in order to reduce our average concentrations. below our target. All right, so that was the more complex method. We're just going to look at the same example again, but this time we'll look at using advanced methods. So everything's the same, same data. We've got the same conceptual model, pretty much the same optimization questions. There's some variations on them. But in this case, you know, we're not going to use any of the secondary data. So we'll just assume that that data is not available to us, and we just have to rely on the zinc data itself. So again, here's a summary of the advanced methods. That's from the guidance. You can see the link to where that is located. And the advanced methods, in contrast to the regression methods we talked about previously, the more complex methods, you know, they include a model of spatial correlation. So we actually model the variogram explicitly. And this works best when we have a lot of data available to us to in order to construct that model of the variogram and to do, generate predictions. So we need some data kind of spread out throughout the whole area to make sure we can predict throughout the area that we're interested in. There are also, of course, some assumptions associated with these methods. And the main one is that the data are stationary. In other words, if we look throughout our area of interest, that the statistical properties are the same as we, you know, kind of move around looking at different areas. So there's not some area that's, you know, a lot more, a lot more variability than others. So because we're kind of using one model to represent the entire area. So if one part of that area is significantly different than the others, then the model won't work in that area. So do be mindful of that. The main methods of are kriging and co-kriging, and there's all kinds of different variations on those. There's the point and block versions, where we're point is where we're estimating at a single point, and blocks where we're estimating over little areas. And then kind of an extension of this is the method of conditional simulation, where we'll talk about that a little bit more too. So moving on here, as I said, these advanced methods require an explicit model of autocorrelation, and that's just a few typical choices that we make. So we're kind of picking these types of curves, you know, exponential, Gaussian, linear, matern, power, and spherical. And they all have different shapes. I'm going to fit those to our actual variogram generated from the data. So we want to pick one that tends to fit the shape of the variogram. So, you know, here we've got our empirical variogram for this data, and then, you know, here's our, you know, choices of which variogram models we could use. So we can take a look at that. I guess we have a little poll here to look at which of these methods you think would be appropriate. And you can pick more than one, because they're all sort of somewhat similar shaped, and many of them have similarities. So kind of think about, pick which ones would be appropriate and which ones wouldn't. You can put a checkbox next to the ones that could be okay. Now, of course, you want to think about two main things, sort of what's happening down here by the origin. We have kind of what shape is it, do you see in the data? And then also what happens up here as you go to farther distances. Is the variogram unbounded, meaning does it keep going up and up and up, or is there a sill that's present in the data that should be represented by that model? So I'll give people a few more minutes to give your answers. So you remember, you can pick as many of those as are appropriate, and just avoid the ones that just look like they really would not fit the empirical variogram. Okay, it looks like most people have had a chance to answer that. So let's just look here. So first of all, I'd say, you know, the linear variogram doesn't really fit because this just keeps going up and up and up. It's an unbounded one. So that one's probably not going to work for this data that has a sill. And similarly, the power also does the same thing. The only other one I'd probably get rid of is the Gaussian, just because it has a little, you know, sort of a little curve down by the origin, and we don't really see that in our data. You know, otherwise these would all be perfectly suitable. You know, I'll just point out that the exponential and the Matern ones are pretty similar, and that, you know, the Matern really is sort of the most flexible, and it can kind of include the exponential, but we'll get into a little bit more about what that looks like in a second of fitting the variograms to our data. Okay. So here is what it would look like if we just fit an exponential model. So that was one of the ones that's clearly appropriate, and we see reasonably good fit to the data, and we're really mainly interested in this area that's in the smaller distances. So, you know, we don't really care when we get way out here past the range of our data, which I think we said was around 800 meters. You don't really care if it fits out here, because that's not going to be important. We really want it to fit well down here by the origin. So here we see we have a non-zero nugget, because this line doesn't hits the y-axis above zero. So we have a non-zero nugget, so we won't be exactly interpolating with this variogram model. One thing just to remind when you're reviewing reports that you should always see a plot of the variogram. You know, they should say what kind of variogram they're using and plot the fit of that variogram to the data so you can visually assess whether it looks reasonable or not. All right, so one little trick here about doing the variogram modeling. If we have a lot of trend in our data, such as here's an example here where we've got a map of groundwater elevation, and we've sort of, you know, just to show the trend, I just sort of fit a little spline to it so you kind of see, you know, the trend. And if you do a variogram of that trended data with a big trend in it, you'll kind of always get this result of an unbounded variogram. So here I'm actually just showing, just for the so you can see what it would look like, the variogram cloud, which is basically every single point that makes up the variogram. So I've kind of taken the distance between each of the sample points and calculated the semi variance and plotted it as a function of the distance apart those two points are. But normally we fit a sort of a smooth line to it so we can kind of see the trend more easily. So here we have an unbounded variogram, and generally what you can do is just remove the trend from the data first. The range of the spatial correlation and so forth. So we're looking at using a kriging method here. There's many different types of kriging, and listed some of them here, and they basically differ not in what they do with the variogram, but really what they do with the trend part of the model. So, you know, kriging generally fits some sort of a trend to the spatial correlation model to fit the residuals from, you know, from that trend. So kind of have different versions of the trend, and basically, just to cut to the chase, you know, our recommendation is just to use ordinary kriging unless you have a really good reason not to. But most of the time, you know, ordinary kriging, where you've you know, kind of detrended the data if it needs to be detrended first, is going to be the way to go. All right, so here's what it looks like if we use a spherical variogram with ordinary kriging, and we can kind of compare that to the exponential variogram. So both of these models seemed, you know, okay on visual inspection, and, you know, when we run them through the ordinary kriging algorithm, you know, we get fairly similar results. If you look closely, you see some tiny little differences, but generally they look pretty similar. So we want to think about whether these models are working well. So we're going to evaluate whether they're consistent with the conceptual site model. They look fine so far, and verify the assumptions, and then go into a little bit more detail about how to use cross-validation to more quantitatively evaluate how the model works. Now, cross-validation can be used with any method at all, even the simple methods. And generally, we'll use take-one-out cross-validation, because that's kind of the simplest and kind of easiest to use. All we do is just run the prediction algorithm a bunch of times, and each time we take out one of the data points and try and use the method to predict the value at that missing data point, and then we can compare the prediction with the actual data that we had taken out there. And that allows us to look at the error, the accuracy of the predictions, and also the accuracy of our standard errors, or how well the model is evaluating a prediction error. So it's kind of what it would look like if we did cross-validation on, did it with three different models, actually. I threw in inverse distance weighting here, just so you could see what it would look like for a simple method. And we can compare it to ordinary Kriging with the exponential varigram and then ordinary Kriging with the spherical varigram. So what we've done, as I said, is we took one out, one of the data points out, and then we used the model to predict it. And so, for example, you know, here's a data point right here, where you know the actual data value was around down here it was like a 5, but the prediction was closer to 6. So that was pretty far off. Because if it was doing a perfect job, then all the data would be along this diagonal line here. So that's what we're shooting for, to make it. We want the results to be as close to that diagonal line as possible. But what we see is all these too high for the lower values and too low in the higher values. And that's because all these methods are smoothing out the data. They're smoothing off the tops of the peaks and smoothing out the bottoms of the valleys in our data. So we always see that with these kind of methods, that we get a smoothing approach. And that's just important to keep in mind. But we can look a little bit more detail on which one's done better by looking at some statistics based on these cross-validation results. So in addition to graphing them, we can kind of calculate these cross-validation statistics. So first we'll just look at the mean error and the root mean square error. So we just take all the errors, all the little data points, and take the average of them. And the root mean square is where we take out the negatives, we sort of, you know, square, take the means of those, take the square root. So obviously these are errors, so we want these numbers to be small. So we kind of see, you know, inverse distance weighting has a higher error. It's negative, so it kind of has a negative bias. And, we're doing a little better on the two variants of ordinary Kriging with the two different varigrams. But basically here with the root mean square, we see inverse distance weighting doesn't do as well. The two Kriging ones do pretty much the same. They're both perfectly good. So the other thing we can do is look at the how well the method's going to do in estimating the error in its own predictions. Now, we can't do this with simple methods. So we have NAs here. Can't do it with the simple methods because they don't provide a measure of uncertainty in the predictions. So we can take the errors between the, you know, so we're taking looking at the error between the standard error that comes out of the model and the actual standard error that we see when we compare the prediction and the actual data. So we want the means to be really small, but we don't look at the standardized ones, which are kind of a little easier to evaluate. We want those to be close to 1, meaning that the model is doing a perfectly good job of estimating the error. So here we see maybe the exponential varigram is doing a little bit better with representing those errors, because its root mean square, its standardized error, is closer to 1. Here's another reminder for when you're reviewing these geospatial reports. You should see some mention of cross-validation, because they should evaluate the quality of the model and how well it's doing with predictions and estimates of uncertainty. So you should see some kind of a table like this that reports the result of cross-validation. All right, so here we go. Here's the results. We've got the predictions and the prediction standard errors. Again, we're looking at the log of zinc as our thing we're interested in. One thing to point out here with the standard errors, they kind of have this typical Krieging look to them, in that the standard errors are smallest near the data points, and they kind of go out higher as you get farther away from the data points. One of the things that kind of jumps out at me is I see over here, well, you know, we're kind of near the river where we expect concentrations to be highest, but we see some, no data points nearby, so it kind of points out that there's some higher uncertainty here, so maybe we want to do some more sampling there. So now we can combine those predictions and the standard errors to get a upper 95% confidence limit. So this is what it would look like. So here's, we don't expect the mean zinc concentration to be higher than this, other than maybe 5% of the time. So most of the time it's going to be lower than this upper confidence limit. So this is what we might use to compare to action levels if we have those. All right, so just to show a little variation on Krieging, so kind of doing the same thing, but instead of doing point Krieging, we'll do block Krieging, where we're kind of looking at little square, these little 100-meter squares. You kind of see it kind of smooths out. We're just getting, these are actually results for little blocks instead of points. So it kind of smooths things out, and that might make sense to do if you're, for example, have a certain area that you're kind of is your kind of decision unit. You can like either excavate it or not. You can't really go to a smaller unit than that because of the size of the equipment that you'll be using. And maybe block Krieging makes sense to do. All right, so now we'll just think a little bit more beyond Krieging to simulation. And you know, as I said, the one downside of our predictions from both the regression methods and these Krieging methods is that the estimates are quite smooth. You know, they don't really reflect all the variability that we see in reality. Here's a little diagram of here's our sample points, these little circles, and you know, we don't really know what's going on exactly between the points. And there's all kinds of possibilities that could be actually happening. It could be wiggling around like in this solid line, or wiggling around like in this dashed line. Many different possibilities, because we only know what's going on at the data points themselves, where we have the samples. So, we can use simulation to sort of help us appreciate better what's going on in between the places where we have data. So here's an illustration of what that might look like for our zinc data set. So here we've got some simulations. I'm showing four different simulations. So each of the simulations honors the data that we have. It matches the data where we have samples. And they're all consistent with the variogram, in that the spatial correlation that we see is consistent with that variogram model. And you kind of see that the results are not at all smooth, like we get out of Krieging or the more complex methods, and it kind of all different. And so we can kind of do these simulations for many times, maybe 1,000 times, try and summarize the results, and that gives us a good sense of the uncertainty we have, a little better than some of the other methods we have. So. The other nice thing is we can kind of calculate the uncertainty in types of measures that we can't easily do with Krieging. So here we want to look at, the area of the, what's the area that has zinc concentrations greater than 1,000 milligrams per kilogram. So for each of those little simulations, 1,000 simulations, we'll look at the area above 1,000, and we'll kind of add it up in, square kilometers, then plot the histogram of what we get. So here's all the different possibilities. And we sort of see, the most common area is something a little less than 300. But there's a big range where we could have a possibility, maybe from 200 to, almost up to 500. So we can kind of think about that range of possible errors and how likely they all are. And that could be very useful for decision making. All right, so moving on from conditional simulation, just to look a little bit at co-creating. And this is where we're going to kind of combine two different types of data in a creating approach. One of the areas where it works the best is when we have two types of data that are kind of on different scales or different accuracies. Now, this, Adam, in response to one of the questions where you had two data with different measurement accuracy or, some old data and some new data, you could use co-creating to evaluate that. In this example, though, we're looking at a situation where we're measuring something in great detail, in great accuracy, but just in a few spots. And we're going to combine that with some geostatistical approach where we kind of have a lot of a lot of data points covering the whole area, but they're not exactly measuring what we want. So the geophysics doesn't tell us, concentration. It gives us, something like electrical conductivity, something like that. So co-creating is a way of optimally, fusing those two types of data together and give you a prediction that's consistent with both of them. So here's the prediction here. All right. So here's kind of at the end of this section, and just remind you of some questions to make sure you ask when you're reviewing geospatial analyses, that particularly those that use these kind of more complex or advanced methods. You really want to see a very clear description of what method was used. They shouldn't just say, yeah, we put it into Surfer and this is what came out of it. There's many different methods available in that software, and so we want more details about which one was selected and why. Why was one method selected over the other? How can we show that this method's the best and it's fitting the data properly? We need to see all that described. And we'd like to see some quantitative evaluation of that using cross-validation, or at the very least some plots of the fit to the variogram, make sure it looks okay, and that there should be some description of the prediction uncertainty and how that was assessed. Finally, I think we always want to just go back to that conceptual site model and make sure the results are consistent with it. You shouldn't be, contouring the water levels right across a fault or right across a river, with no care about how that physical feature is going to affect the results. So, and that is everything for this section. And next, we're going to go into putting GRO into practice with Mike Kaczynski.
Thanks, Chris. In this part, I'm going to go over using the guidance itself. So Adam and Chris have already walked us through the fundamentals and some of the methods that you can use for conducting your geospatial analyses. And we've seen some examples of putting the methods into use and what they produce. In this part of the presentation, I'm going to go over some of the parts of the guidance that can be put to use immediately, and you can use these tools to help make your projects more successful, and also to help you communicate your use of geospatial analysis with your clients and to regulators. The guidance produces or provides information to you and tools you can use on several levels. It provides a basic understanding of the geospatial methods and the results, and it also provides a nuts and bolts type how-to explanation of implementing those methods.
Mike, a few people are having trouble hearing you, so if you could speak up as loud as you can, that'd
Sorry?
Be great.
Great.
A few people are having trouble hearing you.
Gotcha.
Thank you.
This guidance is a companion to ITRC's groundwater statistics and monitoring compliance guidance. The groundwater statistics for environmental managers internet-based training, and the remediation process optimization guidance. And just as a reminder, geospatial analysis happens all the time. Anytime you infer a flow direction or create isocontours of any type or look at soil or groundwater data by location or even over time, you're performing geospatial analysis. Anytime you assign a value, a data point to a location where you don't have empirical data and you're basing that assignment of the value on the surrounding empirical data that you do have, you're performing geospatial analysis. And that can be an issue, especially when it comes to presenting your data to a regulator. You're trying to get them to make decisions based on data that is inferred rather than collected. So this guidance is a great tool to help you do that. It's a little different than some of the older ITRC guidance. On the web version, you'll find the glossary and the list of acronyms at the bottom of each page, accessible by a button. And so I'd like to go through now just some of the basics of navigating through this particular guidance. It starts off with a fact sheet. These are available online and also as a PDF. So if you need a paper copy and you're working remotely, they're available to you. And they kind of go, fact sheets 1 through 4 are sequential and they walk you through the process. So fact sheet 1 walks you through the basics. It gives you an explanation of how you can use geospatial analysis during the various life cycle stages of a project. It helps address issues associated with coming up against regulatory barriers and provide some optimization examples. Fact sheet 2 walks you through whether your site conditions are applicable to geospatial analysis and whether you've got an appropriate data set to attempt to apply geospatial analysis. Also provides information on potential misapplications and answers some specific questions relative to the various life cycle stages. Fact sheet 3 walks you through how the geospatial models and analyses are conducted, walks you through building the geospatial model, helps you check that the model produces reasonable results. As Chris mentioned when he was wrapping up, you want to use these tools as part of your conceptual site model iterative process. So you're running the models, you're seeing if they make sense against what you know about the site, and you're using those tools to update your conceptual site model. If your modeling results are wildly different than what you know, either your conceptual site model is wrong or something in your model selection has gone awry. And then Fact Sheet 4 walks you through some of the software packages that are available to help you perform these analyses. So from Fact Sheet 1, this is just pointing you to if you're running into problems with using or presenting geospatial analysis, use this guidance as a reference to point your client or your regulator to help explain the reasoning that you used for selecting your model, performing your interpretation. It can be used as a way to explain how you made decisions regarding the assessment you've conducted or the remediation you've performed or a proposed monitoring plan, for example. So it's not just a tool to help you perform the analyses, but it's also a reference that you can use to help encourage acceptance of the use of geospatial analysis as a way to support your conceptual site model. Specifically for the project managers in our audience, the project manager's toolbox, this links back to the fact sheets and some of the other most immediately useful parts of the guidance for project managers. If you're looking at training your staff on the use of geospatial analysis, this page would be a good one to bookmark to go back to. It's a great training tool. Also, the review checklist. Again, PDF and online versions are available. It's a way to verify proper use of geospatial analyses within your project team. You could also use this as a supplemental submittal to communicate with the regulator that you're dealing with on how you applied the analysis methods to your project. It also, this review checklist points the user to parts of the guidance that are relevant to the question being asked. So if you have concerns about how any of these questions were answered, you can use this checklist to point a reviewer to those parts of the guidance for more information. So it kind of walks you through some of the typical questions and concerns that you're going to run into I'll call it a typical environmental project. Another key part of the project manager's toolbox is choosing the methods. So this part of the guidance walks you through selecting the geospatial methods depending on what data are available to you and the questions that you're trying to ask. And again, as we saw earlier, David pointed out, we've got some flowcharts that help walk you through the process and make decisions. We've got a section on common misapplications. So this is broken out by mistakes that are often made in developing the conceptual site model when performing the exploratory data analysis, as Chris explained, and when using models, and also common mistakes regarding modeling assumptions. Adam and Chris both pointed out that you really have to have a pretty good understanding of the assumptions that go along with the method that you're selecting. It's also very important to communicate those with whoever is going to look at the work that you produce. You know, describe the assumptions that were used and also describe whether they're applicable to the site that you're working on. Another flowchart that helps you choose your method. This flowchart walks you through the requirements of your conceptual site model that have to be met before you attempt your geospatial analysis. Shows you which are available depending on your data set. Again, another very good training tool for your staff if you are bringing some junior staff up to speed on geospatial analysis. Another one for choosing which methods are best depending on the project life cycle stage that you're in. This helps you choose the correct geospatial method depending on what you're trying to address. The example that we see on the screen here walks you through some of the questions that you might need to answer during site characterization, and these are the same type of presentation is available for the other life cycle stages. Again, another great training tool for your staff. Here's a key part of the guidance, the software selection. So if you're not even sure where to start, this would be a great place for the guidance to go to, just to kind of get a feel for what kind of tools are available to you. There's lots of software options available to you depending on your needs. Also depending on what level of skill you have. Maybe you're already an expert at modeling or you're very new to it. This can help you select software applications that are more suited to your level of skill. And of course, as David mentioned, the cost. The software available is going to change over time. New products come out all the time. But this guidance is still a good resource if you don't know where to begin, or if you're looking to upgrade to a more sophisticated application. The comparison tables also help you sort through different ways that you might, depending on your needs, which way you might select the software that's best suited for you. So you can download these Excel tables and filter and sort them. You can choose based on the life cycle category, for example, and these tables help rank the ability of each software application to answer questions associated with each category. Also, if you know what kind of output you want, so for example, if you're looking for maps to help illustrate the point and drive home the key takeaways from your conceptual site model, these tables can also help you choose the software that's going to help you produce that type of output. So you can sort by the project lifecycle stage, which question you're attempting to answer, and it'll rank them by the different software applications that are available. So when you're ready to use the results of your modeling and your geospatial analysis, the section of the guidance called Using Results is there to help you see some ways that you can use your analysis and apply them to your project. So this includes things like hotspot detection. You can take your analysis, if you've got an unknown source, find some ways to try to identify where the hotspots are. Also, coming up with sample spacing, right? You don't want to drill more soil borings or install more wells than you need to. So this is the spot in the guidance that can help you really come up with the best array you can for a monitoring program or optimize your remediation efforts. So here's an example from the guidance, and it kind of answers some of the optimization questions that we've heard from or heard about so far. So when selecting which monitoring points are applicable or best put to use on your project, this could also be used as a way to justify removing wells from a sampling plan. What we're seeing here is a snapshot in time. We've got some monitoring data over time, and this is something that we see here in Colorado as part of the TANKS program. We'll take a look at a contaminant plume over time, but each of these are snapshots. Ideally, you want to take this information and compare it back to some baseline starting point. Taking a look at a plume and comparing it to the progress you've made is a great way to communicate with your regulator where you are, how effective your remediation efforts have been. But again, emphasize explain the modeling assumptions that go along with the methods that you use. Explain how they are applicable to your particular site. Put in some information about how you established your boundary conditions, for example. This is all important information to communicate that will support your conclusions and how you came up with your conceptual site model. Clearly call out, I think it was Adam that was talking about outliers. If you've got data points that you've removed from your data set, make sure you clearly call that out. You know, that's going to support your conclusions, and also just be clear with your reader which data points you're using and aren't using and why. Here's an example in the case studies from the guidance. In this example, the 95% upper confidence limit, of the mean was used for each of the domains shown as blocks here, and they were calculated using creaking block values for pre- and post-excavation conditions. So this is a good way to show that your remediation goals have been achieved. And if you want to take a closer look at this, this is from the case study, lead contamination in soil. So just as we wrap things up, this guidance, it provides some information on the tools that you can use to create data interpretation and presentation items that you can use in support of your conceptual site model. If you use this guidance, it's going to help you perform optimization that will help make your assessments and cleanups more efficient. Just keep in mind these bullet items as we move forward in this. And here's the example that we saw earlier. This is probably one of the key takeaways from our guidance, is that given the same data set, depending on which method you apply to it, you're going to come up with very different interpretations of what it means. So So keep that in mind, and this is also another reason why you need to explain the assumptions that go along with the models that you selected. We've had some questions about different ways that this guidance can be applied. I think someone asked about fires in a landfill. Mostly we use this for contaminant plume information and for geochemistry, but this can be used in a lot of different ways. There's also tools in here that can help you do specific items, such as calculating the contaminant mass. You could estimate the amount of your source lost to result in the plume that you see. Coming up with some other items, you could combine the tools here with your high resolution assessment. So if you're doing an MIP assessment, you can use the tools provided here to map out the areas of contamination. You could use it to determine contaminant storage areas and contaminant transport areas. And each of these could be then analyzed and displayed in a map or a cross-sectional view. Again, different applications are available. It's not just taking a look at estimating things like degradation of plume over time, but you can also back calculate and talk about source strength. If you've got a plume that you can demonstrate its stability through your empirical data, you can use these tools to estimate how much had to be released to make a plume of the size that you see today. So it's not just limited to the contaminant concentrations. You can take a look at things like the plume intensity and extent, and again, probably the most immediately useful items is to come up with, use these tools to come up with proper sample spacing. So that could be for an assessment or continued monitoring, as well as optimizing your remediation efforts. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Juliana.
Thanks, Mike. We are going to have about 15 minutes now for questions, so everyone is welcome to send in questions using that Q&A in the bottom right. I'll also remind you that we do ask you to complete the feedback form, so we do really use your feedback. It's also your opportunity to create a certificate for attending today's training. So if that's something you're interested in, be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify you attended, and the system's going to generate that certificate for you. And if you have more than one person at your location, at that point you can go back and the next person can fill out the feedback form as well. We also have another couple of poll questions that we're going to have open now. Are you ready to use geospatial analysis for optimization at environmental sites? And also, thinking about the projects that you're working on in the next 6 months, how could you use this ITRC guidance document that we've introduced you to today? A couple of questions have come in during the second half, and again, everyone's welcome to use that Q&A pod in the lower right to enter in questions. Chris, a question for you. Can you provide a further explanation of what residuals are?
Yeah, residuals. Basically, it's the difference between what you get from a prediction at a particular place from a model and the actual data. So, you know, if we're looking at one little spot where we have a sample, I look at the sample result, and then I subtract the prediction at that same spot from the model, and then that is called the residual. So. There's just some of the assumptions relate to the residuals. For example, I think the one we looked at was that the residuals aren't autocorrelated. So then we took all the residuals, we put them in the variogram to see whether they were the residuals were correlated with each other.
Is there any such thing as multivariate geospatial analysis or kriging? Most environmental data sets include multiple analytical parameters, but most geospatial analysis that I've encountered are univariate, so that there are multiple parameters there's multiple geospatial analysis would be done. Is there any way to combine them?
Yeah, Yeah, it's a good question. I don't even think we go into it too much in the guidance, but you know, I mean, I think one reason you might want to consider things together is that a lot of the different things would be correlated with each other. So certain concentrations of different analytes would probably be correlated with others. So so there's kind of a difference between putting in all the different chemicals as inputs to the model versus as outputs to the model. So I think, you know, the example of the more complex regression sort of showed how you can combine data from different types of data in to improve the prediction, for example, of looking at the zinc. You know, generally speaking, we wouldn't have multivariate outputs where we're getting outputs of the model for different chemicals, just because that just sort of makes it, that's a very complicated model. And generally speaking, we don't have enough data in order to construct that model, because you need a lot of data to look at all the relationships between all the different variables and predict the output. So by and large, we do predictions of one chemical at a time, but you might want to consider the other chemicals as inputs to your model if they're you know, correlated and it seemed to improve it.
From one of our participants today, would like to hear a bit of explanation for best practices or advice in dealing with field duplicate variability, lab variability, et cetera, or dealing with detection limits, or perhaps varying detection limits.
Yeah, those are all things that we have to deal with a lot of. I mean, many of the more complex and advanced methods don't have any trouble dealing with field duplicates. So you can kind of just throw them in there and to the algorithm. So for example, if you're going to do kriging, then obviously those field duplicates will be very useful for deciding on what the nugget should be of your variogram model, because they're showing you variability in the data that's at, you know, zero distance apart, since they're both taken from the same spot. So those could be quite useful. You know, you can take into account the other sources of variability again when you're selecting the nugget. So the nugget's kind of the variogram. So that's sort of reflecting the measurement error and all sources of measurement error. So if you have some independent information about what the measurement error is, then you should make sure that the nugget is selected to be at least as large as that. So, yeah, I guess in terms of the non-detects, there's, you know, those tend to be a little trickier to handle in geospatial evaluations. So, you know, generally, you know, I think they're not, you know, so I guess in the sort of non-spatial statistical world, we have these methods for dealing with non-detects, but most of the time, I think in geospatial analysis, we just sort of put it in as the detection limit or something like that, and then ignore the fact that it's a non-detect. But, you know, if it's an area of that's very important, then you sort of might want to do some sort of sensitivity analysis to see if that's making that assumption or ignoring the detection part of it is going to make a big difference to your results.
Hey, Chris, this is Staybecker. Just one thing that strikes me is that depending on the purpose that you're doing the geospatial analysis for, you know, say you're interested in trying to map out the limit of a plume at a low value that's close to the detection limit, if you have a bunch of non-detects in those areas, do you think that indicator kriging might be an appropriate way to deal with it, where, you know, anything that's below the standard, say, is given, you know, a value like zero, and anything above it, it's given a value of one, and then you go through the Krieging process, and you basically get a something that's like a probability of being above or below, you know, that standard. Is that maybe a way to deal with areas of, say, a plume that that have a lot of non-detects?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Certainly, indicator Krieging is a sort of classical Krieging approach for dealing with that. It is a little bit tricky to apply, you know, particularly estimating the variograms for the indicator Krieging. So, you know, in general, you know, I think in principle that is the theoretical approach, but in practice it's a fair bit of work to really make it, you know, work right. So certainly something to consider, though, depending on your, you know, if it's a very important application, then it might be worth the effort. You know, so that's a good point.
Please comment on the need to prove your data are spatially correlated prior to contouring your data. If using a simple method like inverse distance weighting, is that needed?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you're using a simple method, you know, if you basically just want to make a nice looking map of your data, you know, you don't have to evaluate the spatial correlation. You can just stick it into the algorithm, inverse distance weighting or whatever it is, and take a look at the map that comes out of it and just evaluate it visually to see if it seems to reflect all the features and aspects of the conceptual site model that you think it should. And oftentimes, if you have a lot of data, it will look fine. You don't really need to go any further. I think the nice thing about doing the variogram is more for the information it gives you about the range of the spatial correlation. So it's very difficult to just eyeball a map and figure out what the, you know, range of spatial correlation is. So to answer that question, putting the data in the variogram is very useful, and you can use that range of spatial correlation to think about optimizing your sampling plan and things like that that are kind of go beyond just mapping the data, but are often you know, quite useful.
Are there user groups that someone can join to get help?
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly of user groups. I mean, I know, you know, it's kind of the EPA Clue-In website, you know, has some email notifications of reports and stuff that, and many of them cover optimization topics, and often, you know, geospatial analyses are part of that, but it's not really specific to geospatial analysis. So maybe others have some other suggestions. I don't know.
Dave McCrag. Yeah, go ahead, Mike. Sorry.
Oh, we're probably about to say the same thing. We've got in the back of the guidance, additional information, team contacts. I can't guarantee that all these people will be always available to you, but depending on the nature of your question, there are some folks that you can reach out to there.
And is there a, maybe you guys know if there's a user group for ARC GIS, you know, because that has, you know, some of the geostatistical kind of capabilities in it. I wonder if there's a user group there that might also be a resource. Anybody know?
Yeah, I mean, certainly there is a you know, fairly active, you know, it's kind of on their websites of community support type websites. So lots of people answering questions that people have. And I guess even on, you know, Stack Overflow, a type of website for people, you know, answering technical questions, there's some focusing on GIS and geostatistics or statistics. So, you know, I think there are those kind of places where you could look at people's questions that they had and answers that were provided. And if you find the one that fits what you're doing, that's great. Or you can actually ask your own question and get some expert answers. So that's kind of like a user group, but I'm not sure that's exactly what the questioner was asking about.
Thank you. Looking at our poll results, about half and half on people who are ready to use geospatial analysis and those who still need to learn more. And for both groups, I do encourage you to go to the guidance document. It's a great tool. Also, thinking about projects that you're working on, we have a wide variety of answers that have come in, and participants have been able to scroll down and see those answers as others have answered this question. We are out of time for today's training class, so we'll go ahead and wrap